Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. Delving further into the conversations about the cultures of consciousness. Lots of C words there. Somehow I can't get away from that phrase. It just says what I'm trying to do. Today we're going to be talking about something I've been fascinated with for a long time, though I am not really a game player, and I'm not really sure why. I've never been much of a game player, and whether it was board games or role-playing games or video games, I did do my share. You know, I've tasted it. I beat Tempest. I took it all the way to the end. But basically, I'm not a huge game player, but I'm fascinated with them. And I've read a great deal about games. I know a lot of game players. I understand a lot about game systems. But for whatever reason, I'm not that interactive with them. That said, I've been fascinated for quite a long time with the connection between magic and games. It was something I wrote about in Technosis, which I have to say got republished again just recently. So run out and get a copy if you never have. But one of the most fun chapters to write in there was all about the weird connection between particularly role-playing games and magic, going back, of course, to Dungeons and Dragons. But then more interestingly, following it forward as the RPG model, as they say, moved into the interwebs, onto Usenet and other sorts of technologies, MUDs and MUs, and you suddenly had the introduction of magic and gaming into a digital space, which brought the whole issue of digital code into the picture. And of course, this, you know, has ran like gangbusters, and magic and the occult remain a significant part of a large number of not just role-playing games, but any number of computer games. And I think that's true for a reason. Today we're going to be digging into some of those reasons with Jeff Howard, who is actually has a gig of all things, a professor of game development and design at Dakota State University, and he wrote a terrific, fascinating new book called Game Magic, which is the kind of book that I like had envisioned when I did my research, you know, over 20 years ago. There were, you know, people talking about this stuff, but I was like, you know, someday there's going to be like games and the occult, and they're going to both be at the same high level, and they're going to be talking about how programming language is like a ritual spell, and how ritual spells from history can help us organize the game space. And I was so excited about all this stuff, even though, again, I was not actually a game player, but just conceptually and imaginatively. And these elements were already in fantasy stories. You could already see it happening on the internet in the early to mid 90s. And then here it is. It's like the grimoire from the future. And it really is a grimoire. That's what's so great about this book. It's like, if you just like grimoires, even if, again, you know, a lot of people buy grimoires, they're not magical practitioners. I can, you know, that's a clear one. But this isn't just a book about game design or about even how to use the magic systems in fantasy literature or in the history of the occult to make better magic in games. But it really is kind of an arcanum unto itself. It's very sophisticated about magic, and it seems to be so about games. And I look forward to talking to Jeff very much, because it's really fascinating to think what's going to happen into the future. So especially with all sorts of new devices coming down the line and game culture becoming as huge as it is. So I look forward to the conversation very much. But before I bring Jeff on, of course, we introduce the White Witch of Los Angeles, Maja Dao. Hi, Maja.
Hi.
You know, we've talked about our mutual lack of intense game playing, but you've had your share.
It's true. And one of the things, you know, I study divination deeply, and if you get to the heart of divination, it's literally the origin of all the games people play, like tarot cards and playing cards. And dice originates back to, like, the Saturnalia stuff. So actually, if you look at even, like, simple board games, not counting all of these, you know, very higher developed role-playing game scenarios, but pretty much the way that people make systems is really, like, at the heart of a lot of the divination stuff that I look at. And, of course, like, I Ching, there's some arguments that even computer programming and binary number systems could have been based on, you know, the way that I Ching systems go. So even though, you know, like you said, we don't get epically into it, I have definitely had a lot of research into it in there. And then, of course, myself, on a lower level, of course, played Dungeons and Dragons a lot. And then, you know, some other basic things like that.
Well, it's funny you mentioned this sort of history of games and not just divination, but just cosmology, metaphysics. I can remember fondly in the 70s, they put out an edition of a Tibetan game that was basically Snakes and Ladders, which is a very, very cosmological game that goes quite far back. And it was a reproduction of a medieval version of the game from Tibet from, I don't know, the 15th century or the 16th century called Rebirth. And basically it was like Snakes and Ladders, and the cells that you were going up were these various hell realms and then middle realms and then heaven realms. And there were dozens and dozens of these, and you would, you know, climb up and fall down, you know, based on the, you know, on the throw. And it was, and I remember it very vividly because we played it with a friend of mine named, Naropa, and for the life of him, he could not get out of hell.
as the game kept going further and further,
the sort of symbolic weight of not being able to get out of hell, it became more and more excruciating as we, the other players, climbed up towards the delightful heavens where we're smelling flowers and, you know, achieving ecstatic bliss with the universe. And he's like lacerated.
Crazy. I had an experience with Snakes and Ladders that was literally like Jumanji. It was crazy. My friend and I were playing this epic game. It was a reprint by Johari, whatever his name is, that guy that does all the Indian chakra drawings, and we played this epic game of it. It lasted, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 hours, and as we went through each of the things were things that literally we had both gone through individually in our lives, but it was only saying it for, like, each of us was different, and the different path that we both took, like, corresponded crazily to events that were occurring. So it's so funny, that symbolic value of your friend not being able to make it. It gets weird and freaky, like correlating when you play games. Some of those weird consciousness things and synchronicities absolutely have room to come out.
Well, it's also a way to understand how magic works, because even if you're not into the supernatural in any kind of sort of ontological way, you can understand already how powerful games are. And so you just add ritual, add belief, add intensity into that, and things can get pretty wild just on the level of human practices. But with that, let's invite Jeff onto the show. Jeff, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind. Hello, Senor Jeff. I can see that you're on the device, and yet I do not hear your name or voice.
Hi, Eric.
Hey, there we go.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Well, welcome on the show.
Thanks.
And congratulations on Game Magic. It's really quite a feat. You know, I want to reemphasize that since I know more about the occult than I do about games, I can only really speak for the former. But the way that you understand and sort of present the history and present the kind of grammar of the occult and magic is very engaging and sophisticated. And I assume that if you're doing the same thing with the myriad of games that you're talking about, you really have made quite a fascinating grimoire. And maybe partly because, as I said, I'm not that deep into the game world, if you could even sort of locate your work in terms of how central are these issues in terms of, you know, how many, you know, contemporary game designers are still using magic systems inside their games, or looking to magic to make the games more interesting. And then how central are these issues to a lot of the things that game designers are working on today?
You know, I think that the issues are really central And I think that part of that is coming from the location of many, many games in sort of fantasy worlds, worlds that are inspired by various fantasy novels and Tolkien and Game of Thrones and that kind of thing. And because of that kind of inspiration of fantasy literature that was in Dungeons and Dragons and continues to exert such a powerful influence on games, magic is very pervasive in so many different game genres and types of games. And I think that we're at an interesting crossroads in that magic has become so pervasive in so many different types of games that it's almost a little bit in danger of losing some of its magic and losing some of its enchantment. So one of the goals of my work is to sort of help designers put the magic back into magic systems, kind of rediscover some of that mystery and some of that contact with the unknown and worlds beyond. But there's lots of designers who are exploring this in various ways. And, the example that I come back to a lot is the work of the designer named Dennis Dyack, who's had a few studios, Silicon Knights, Precursor Games, and most recently a studio called Quantum Entanglement. And his work has really involved... he had a game called Eternal Darkness, Sanity's Requiem, which involved this beautiful rune-based magic system, which you were sort of learning these... You were learning the grammar of magic. You were learning the combinations of runes and colors and their relationship to a set of sort of neo-Lovecraftian gods. And so, Dyack and his work has kind of paved the way for all sorts of designers who are working today, many of them deeply inspired by sort of new technologies and new technologies for controlling games, for providing input. So, for example, the game Sons of Nor, which uses the Emotive Brainwave headset in order to allow players to control magic with their thoughts, to change reality solely with the power of their mind. Of course, there are many gestural peripherals like the Kinect or the PlayStation Move or Leap Motion, which are allowing designers on games like Fable the Journey or Fantasia Music Evolve to kind of realize this fantasy of pointing and causing an alteration in reality.
Hey, Jeff, I want to talk about the gestural stuff a little bit more later, but let's just even stay with the first point about the combinatory logic of building runes and symbolism. And that was one of the things that was so fascinating about reading your book, again, more from someone who knows the history of the occult and fantasy literature, but really specifically the occult, is, as you say, you get into the grammar of magic, that in a way, like, looking at the occult systems from a game designer point of view also lets you learn something about how the occult actually works, meaning not all the sort of the atmosphere and the aesthetics and the sort of enchantment and the wonder of it, but really more how it works as a language. And scholars do the same kind of work that you're talking about, where they start to analyze, well, how do these things combine and recombine? And one of the things that it seems to me is that the more sophisticated the magic systems are in games, the more that you, as you're gaining skills, is you're actually gaining skills in the language. You're learning how to speak the language, how to combine different runes, or how to link different colors or different gestures in different kinds of contexts in the game, rather than just saying, oh, I have a magic power sword and I can, it lets me kill more trolls, and then at a certain point it runs out and I need to get another spell, which is very mechanical. And a lot of the magic in games is very mechanistic, at least that I'm familiar with. But then a lot of these things that you're describing are much more sophisticated, but they're sophisticated because they are trying to understand and exploit and play with this combinatory thing where you're building new sentences, as it were, out of these different elements of the occult system. So I don't know if you could just talk a little bit more about that, maybe even in terms of your own, you know, your own work that you're doing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think that, as you alluded to, I do describe game magic as a grimoire, and the word grimoire goes back to the old English word grammary, which means grammar, which, you know, and this is kind of in part related to the medieval distrust of learning. So the idea that the schoolmaster who was carrying around like a Latin grammar book, maybe he had magic powers. But it's also, I think, that kind of language, that origin of the word grimoire etymologically suggests that at the heart of the occult is a deep reverence for the combinatorial power of symbols. And of course we could see this in Kabbalah, which is at some levels a mystical system built out of interpretation. We could see it in Enochian. And whether we think of Enochian as a constructed language or a discovered language, it is a language with a grammar, and that's what gives the Enochian system so much fascination for scholars. This is that it can be explored and recombined to create sort of new spells and new systems. So yeah, I do believe that the more sophisticated a magic system, the more it tends toward having a combinatorial linguistic element. And, you know, one of the potential problems that I see in some of those languages, you know, we've had kind of linguistic magic systems, combinatorial rune-based magic systems, going all the way back to a game like Dungeon Master, which was a 1980s dungeon-crawling role-playing game. But a lot of times, those languages end up having a limited vocabulary, and the things that the symbols can refer to in this world or in other worlds become limited. And so we find an awful lot of magic systems where there might be runes or symbols, but the symbols can only stand for the the four classical Greek elements, air, water, fire, and earth. And maybe somebody throws spirit in for good measure. But, you know, I like to sort of point out to people, look, that's Empedocles. That's a Greek shaman who had a very particular worldview. And there are, in fact, many, many other things that we could say with combinatorial languages. In my own work, in the various iterations of my ongoing game project, Arcana, I've really tried to emphasize the idea that there can and maybe should be sort of an orthogonal relationship between the words in a magical language and the things in a simulated world. In other words, we want as many symbols as there are things in the world, and we want as many things in the world as there are symbols. And if we do that, then we can create rich languages and rich worlds that are not simply constrained to the four physical elements or their metaphorical associations, but could instead be emotional and metaphysical. So I've been trying to build correspondences, you know, where color might relate to emotion, or runes might relate to other planes of existence, to planes of aggression or benevolence. And this is something where the existing occult systems, the Golden Dawn system, for example, or more recently, Andrew Chumbly's, occultist Sabbatai and Azoasia and all of that, can really provide us with richer, deeper, more varied languages that have more symbols and more things to talk about. And in turn, we can be inspired to create our own game languages of symbolic correspondences that let us alter a simulated reality in nuanced and creative ways.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's almost like the difference of a bunch of people that have just been eating at McDonald's all the time suddenly get introduced to like fancy gourmet food, and they're like, oh my God, I didn't even know this was here. So by expanding languages, people who maybe have been using limited languages and limited symbols that don't use all of the available symbols in reality are almost like having this sort of cheaper McDonald's-ish experience of the world, whereas you could increase that and have maybe a more kind of broadened one.
Yeah, and sometimes in addition to a grimoire, I think of my book as a cookbook. So it makes sense that you mentioned McDonald's and you mentioned food. Because one of the things I'm trying to do is sort of offer recipes for subtler flavor combinations, for maybe meatier or more nutritious flavor combinations in magic. And yeah, you know, the shooting somebody with a fireball is a exciting game experience. Sometimes I enjoy it in the same way that I enjoy a Big Mac ever so often from McDonald's. But you know, you start to realize that there have been magic systems that were, you know, that were about changing many aspects of reality, affecting emotional reality and inspiring love, that might be about spiritual or metaphysical reality, accessing other planes of existence. And, you know, once we realize that there is sort of a history of kind of gourmet magic system cooking, that it doesn't have to be McDonald's, then we can sort of be inspired to new heights of subtlety and gourmet cooking.
So here's another question for you. Again, because I'm not that deep in the world, I may be speaking from ignorance, but my impression was that a lot of people I know who are game players and even a few game designers who I've spoken to often complain about the conservatism of the industry, the sort of sense that while there's so many creative things to do that, and there's so many ways of pushing the envelope in all these different directions, emotional, gestural, conceptual, cosmological. I mean, there's so many, it's such an open field that nonetheless, just because of the economics and the you know, pop culture race to the bottom and all that, that there's kind of a dumbness to a lot of games, or a sort of need to keep things either simple or to keep them sort of limited in some ways or another. Now, maybe that's not your opinion and I'm just, you know, not really aware of it, but when you're talking, it sounds very interesting to me, but it also sounds, well, somewhat esoteric. And I'm wondering whether you feel that this more sophisticated development of magic systems by designers makes just better games, so that even people who just want to have a fun time, who don't really care about the Golden Dawn or the history of correspondences and, you know, Western thought or whatever,
right,
are actually just going to have a better time because there's more nuance and there's more multiple dimensions of their actions and activities in the game world.
Yeah, I think that the latter position there, the idea that people will have a better time if the magic systems are more sophisticated, I think I would incline toward the second position there, in the sense that I think gamers are, as a culture, a lot smarter than maybe we give them credit for, or maybe that corporations give them credit for. I think that, people, there's actually a lot of learning that goes on in game design, and that at some level, we as human beings are sort of, we are wired to learn. And we get, you know, dopamine release. We get a deep pleasure from problem solving and from exploring a system and figuring things out, even if we don't know we're learning. Maybe especially if we don't know we're learning. If the learning is sort of hidden and subtle, or to use a common vocabulary, occult. Right. If the learning is hidden, if the learning is beneath the surface, then it's something that can engage people very deeply. And I think about, there's a science fiction writer, Theodore Sturgeon, who once said, he formulated Sturgeon's Law, which is 90% of everything is crap. And he said this as a way to defend science fiction, because he was a science fiction writer. And people at the time, science fiction wasn't well accepted as a kind of medium that could convey ideas or be serious. And so people would say to him, well, you know, 90% of science fiction is just a bunch of, astronauts with ray guns blowing up bug-eyed monsters, and it's just crap. And his response was, yeah, but 90% of everything is crap. Like 90% of symphonies are crap, and 90% of novels are crap. And so what I like to look for is the 10% that isn't crap. The 10% that is that is deep and complex and has hidden depths. And, you know, it's surprising, especially in the field of independent games, where designers are sort of, they have the opportunity to be motivated by creativity and rather than a bottom line, and rather than than a lot of money that they've got to recoup from this, huge AAA multi-million dollar game. We are seeing more and more indie designers who are developing very strange and interesting magic systems, almost as a kind of counterculture. And I look at the work of somebody like Lilith is her pseudonym, and she collaborates with an individual named Liz Ryerson. And both of those game designers self-identify as witches. That's the way they think of themselves. And their witchcraft is something that sort of manifests through games that kind of deconstruct the tropes of role-playing games that we're kind of used to. So, for example, there is a game called Crypt Worlds, which sort of markets itself as a role-playing game, where you're getting more powerful and gaining items and all of this kind of stuff. But the upper world of that game is ruled by Puritans, and like Thanksgiving Puritans, but really they're just cardboard cutouts of Thanksgiving Puritans. And they say things like work, 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 make money, make money, make money. But you realize the more you explore that game, that the crypt worlds of the title are in fact inhabited by an underground of witches. And these witches are having great fun subverting the norms of the upper world. And so I like to think of magic as something, in games that sort of runs against the baseline simulation of the world. So if the game says there is gravity, then a floating spell is running counter to that simulation, running counter to that gravity. And I think of sophisticated game magic in the same way. It's a counter force. It's a counter culture that pushes back against the corporations that are telling us that only mindlessness is fun, and instead advances a position that says people have been engaged in magic since the dawn of time, in part because magic is fun, and its fun consists in its metaphysical depth and the exploration of its mysteries, and that this is something that our gamer audiences are much more ready for than our corporate overlords might lead us to believe. So
that was a good, rich little mini rant. I love the connection between, and I just kind of want to say it again just to underscore it, the connection between a kind of counter-cultural resistance even inside of a major cultural economy like the game world,
right,
and the counter simulation, or the way in which the spells work against the sort of laws of physics that are running a realm. And in fact, you need that tension for it to really work. That's I think a very interesting idea, and I think that's true even among contemporary occultists, regardless of whatever they quote unquote believe. Right. There's also a way in which there's something inherently, if not countercultural, then at least utopian in the sense of imagining another place, another way things can be than the way they are.
Yes.
Actually, I think we'll take a break right now. There's a bunch of stuff I want to ask you about, and I know Masha has got some questions too. But we're going to take a break. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Masha Daou. We're speaking with Jeff Howard about game magic, and we'll be back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis, speaking today with Jeff Howard on game magic. Jeff, before the break and in the beginning of the show, you've been talking a lot about the diversity that a lot of these gaming systems will open folks to and how it expands and opens for a plethora of different kind of modalities and thinking. But I was wondering if in your experience with all this kind of surveillance of so many different games, if you noticed or saw any patterns of like a single thing that was in that could be like a unifier between them. In other words, like for all these different individuals that are making these kind of innovative things, is there like a cohesive theme or themes that you see that pop up pretty consistently?
I think there definitely are themes. And the recurrent patterns that I sort of see is actually kind of a visual motif, a diagram that comes back over and over again, which is the idea of a color pie. And so one of the things that happens in magic systems is that there are different schools of magic. And school not so much in the sense of like a college, although it certainly could be, but like a school of thought, a way of thinking about the world. So the school of creation magic or death magic or alteration, right? So one of the things that we see are diagrams often in the game as a form of interface that represent these different schools of magic as different slices of a pie, or they might be different positions on a rune circle. And, you know, of course, the difference between these different games, or one of the ways that they can be different, is the way they choose to divide up the pie. And this tells you a lot about the world that you're in. So if the pie, you know, is one-third death magic, one-third blood magic, and one-third destruction magic, you're probably in a pretty bleak and gothic world. On the other hand, if the pie is balancing life magic, healing, and destruction magic, and if it's balancing the capacity to create with the capacity to destroy, then we may be in a world that is more mythologically balanced, that is as much dedicated to the Olympian gods as it is to the Thonic gods, to the gods of the underworld. So I think the commonality is a cosmology. Each of these games is creating a cosmology that they are representing as a kind of total pie. A pie of color correspondences, rune correspondences, symbolic correspondences. And the way that the games differ is how they choose to slice up that pie.
Wow, you know, that's amazing.
Another similarity you have there is that all of these things are, you know, running on code. And one of the most interesting sections of your book and your discussion for me was where you explicitly kind of address the way in which code itself, the various language, computer languages that are undergirding the gameplay, are themselves or that can be seen as spells because they're a grammar, a language that makes things happen in the world and makes allows people to express their will by creating things in a, at least in a simulated environment, and then of course also in our real world as well. And you kind of run with that for a while in a really interesting way, talking about how the understanding of code and the creation of code from a designer point of view, it relates to the gameplay that's on the surface that maybe only a player will only perceive as part of the gaming world. And that was very interesting. And you also talked about something called roguelikes, which I'd never heard about before, as a way of understanding this connection between the underlying code and the surface spell as both being, in some sense, you know, interacting in this kind of enchanted language way. So I don't know if you could say a little bit about roguelikes and how the idea of code itself helps inform your vision of game magic.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, so a roguelike is a genre of games that gets its name because it's named after a game called Rogue. So a roguelike is like Rogue. And when Rogue was created, you know, it was back in the 70s, and pretty much all people had were mainframe computers. And those mainframe computers, you know, they'd be in a lab somewhere, and they really didn't have graphics. They had keyboard characters, and you could use those keyboard characters if you wanted to simulate a world. So you could make a dungeon out of the keyboard characters, or you could make a forest of trees. So the thing about roguelikes that makes them so interesting, if we're thinking about magic as programming and programming as magic, is that because the world is made out of keyboard characters and there's not a lot of sort of graphics to distract us, the underlying patterns are much more visible. It's almost like that scene in The Matrix, in the beginning of The Matrix, where you know, everybody's watching the code go by, and then an experienced reader of the code is able to look at it and say, oh, you know, that's a beautiful woman who just walked by inside of The Matrix. So what a roguelike allows one to do, in part because of its keyboard character art, but in part because the source code of roguelikes tends to be open source. So meaning that a person can freely access, read, and modify the code. So there is a kind of parallel between diving deeper and deeper into a dungeon and going deeper and deeper into the layers of code that built the dungeon. And this is something that, you know, the early game programmers at MIT and these other academic institutions, they were very aware of that parallel between exploring a labyrinthine simulated world and exploring the code that underlied it, that was underneath it. And, you know, to speak more broadly about that connection between coding and magic, it's actually a connection that is quite familiar and sort of mainstream in computer science education. Like, there is a textbook that's used at MIT, and it's actually still used as the introductory freshman programming textbook. And it's referred to as the wizard book because it has a wizard on the front of it teaching an apprentice how to cast spells. And the very first paragraph of this textbook says, a computational process is like a spirit. It is intangible. It is potentially deeply powerful. And it only obeys a magician if the magician has mastered the precise symbolic utterances of the incantation and has them in an exact order. So there's this notion that is very foundational to kind of the way programmers have learned historically that connects the power to alter a simulated world and the power to use code in order to affect our real world. And so the two sides of that coin are something that is just deeply built into our kind of cyber culture of programming.
Well, and also the control issue is such a pertinent thing in the occult world. Having to, like, it says you have to build your discipline. It's interesting to think about coders and game makers because it can kind of become like a Frankenstein monster, right? I mean, a lot of the stuff, it to me seems like if you're creating this code as a gamer, maybe, and then you disseminate it, then the forces of chaos kind of invariably come in. So it's interesting that they would make that kind of connection to it as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. And you know, the issue of how much we as coders or occultists control our spirits and how much we want to sort of lose control to our spirits. I mean, it's almost the classic invocation, evocation distinction, calling the spirit into your circle and letting them inspire you in Dionysian fashion, or evoking them, calling them out into the triangle, and keeping them there under control. And I think, you know, it depends on who is sort of doing the control, and this is where I feel like games as an interactive medium, you know, open up some kind of liberating possibilities, because if we were using the code to tell sort of a linear story, you know, if we were kind of coding a linear movie about magic, then the magic could maybe only really go in one direction and only maybe sort of mean one thing, at least on the surface. But because we are coding a simulated world, there are emergent possibilities in our magic that if the combinatorial system is rich enough, players are going to find spells that we maybe never thought of. And they're going to find meanings to those spells that we maybe never thought of either. And, you know, that can be a really liberating thing. It's almost reversing sort of the eye at the top of the pyramid. I mean, as designers and coders, we may think of ourselves as the Illuminati at the top. But once we've coded that world, you know, our players are going to play in it. And through their playing, they're going to uncover new possibilities implied by our code, possible in our code, but unanticipated by us. And, you know, and that's where games, I think, in the coding of games can function as a kind of liberating force.
Well, another liberation that's happening, and you mentioned it earlier on, is the liberation of the body. You know, the body is now being engaged in all sorts of different ways, away from the fingers on a keyboard and or the hands on a controller. There's all sorts of new interfaces that are coming down, and of course the Wii is totally well established now in, you know, whatever, you know, teenage basements across the land, and right. This opens up all this realm of both gestural interaction as well as some of the more, you know, creepy sci-fi brain driven kinds of possibilities as well, which if you just take it down the road a few stages where you're talking about, right, you know, direct brainwave readers, you're talking about Oculus Rift 3D virtual reality worlds, or even deep augmented reality kinds of things, then the ability of these metaphors and analogies, or whatever you want to call them, from magic to sort of seep into the everyday or to engage the body more directly become really very interesting. So I'm curious, for you, when you're looking at all of these different kinds of controllers that are coming down the pike, what are you really most excited about?
Well, I was kind of skeptical of virtual reality for a while, and this has to do with, you know, what happened in the 90s, and we kind of had the fantasy of virtual reality in William Gibson and in things like Lawnmower Man, the movie, The Matrix, certainly. But the technology, in some ways, really wasn't there, and so people would get nauseated because there was too much lag in the headsets and this kind of thing. But when I was out at the Game Developers Conference just about a month ago, it became apparent to me that virtual reality and virtual reality as sort of a game platform or medium modality is here. And it's here, you know, at least to my mind, in a really big way. So, you know, I had the opportunity to play a prototype by a Swedish virtual reality designer that was a magic game. The designer heard I liked magic systems, so he said, you have to see my game. So I put on that Oculus Rift, and there was a pentagram floating in front of me and a sphere around that pentagram. And I put my hands out in front of the Leap Motion sensor, which is a motion sensor kind of akin to the Kinect, but a little more precise and sensitive. And I could squeeze the sphere, and I could tap the pentagram, and sparks of color would appear at the vertices of that pentagram. And then I could release my hand, and a shower of fireworks would, like, you know, like, bolt above my head and explode. And it felt like being It felt like being in another world. And, you know, I know that's been in the ambition of games for a long time, but you know, I felt immersed in a way that I really haven't been before. So I'm very excited about virtual reality. I am also very excited about the possibilities of direct brain control. I think that, you know, we've had the fantasy of telekinesis, the fantasy of the force or mesmeric influence for a long time, being able to move stuff with our minds. And sure enough, there was a game at the Game Developers Conference called Throw Trucks with Your Brain. And that that pretty much said it. And it's really, it's a technological advance that's making that possible. Because when I bought and worked with an emotive brainwave headset like 5 years ago, at that time, you know, there were 16 electrodes on the headset, and you had to have saline solution on the sensors. They were wet sensors, and they had to be in direct contact with your scalp at all times, which explained why a guy like me who has a lot of hair, it wasn't working for me. It also explained why all the emotive employees, they all had mohawks, because, you know, they had to make this headset work. So just the simple, you know, technological transition of now the brainwave sensors are dry sensors, and you know, you don't have to worry about contact with your scalp. That is making all of these kind of cool metaphysical applications of those technologies better. So it's an interesting thing. It's like the more the technology, whether it's virtual reality or whether it's brainwave sensors or motion controllers, like the more precise it becomes in the physical world, the easier it becomes to use in the physical world, the more it is available for kind of imaginative and even metaphysical use.
Yeah, it sounds like really, you know, so many things are open for this. But I wanted to talk to you about what you're working on a little bit more about Arcana. In your book, you compare it a little bit to Minecraft, which I'm totally fascinated with, in the sense that what you're trying to do is not so much, you know, build another game that has an interesting magic system in it, but really kind of create a kind of coding and game space where different kinds of systems can be constructed, tried out, replicated, played with, a sort of open source coding community almost, where these principles can be played with in a different way. I don't know if I'm saying it correctly, but you know, I'd love to hear a little bit more about what you kind of want to achieve with Arcana, which I know is something you're also working with your students in the game design program there.
Sorry, Eric, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay, I'm sorry. It just cut out for a second. So Arcana has both an outward player-facing component. It has a game element that you know is meant to be played by players. But it also has a kind of developer-facing side. And the developer-facing side would be the side that is, you know, a kind of coding language for magic, a kind of visual coding language for magic. So yes, I do sometimes say that Arcana is like the Minecraft of magic systems. You know, but instead of building worlds out of cubes, which is what you do in Minecraft, you're building rituals out of symbols and components. You're sort of building up your own ritual language. This is something that is open to developers. And the idea of Arcana is that underlying it is a kind of in-dimensional vector mathematics. And by that I mean Arcana, the gameplay, is all about shifting between various dimensions, between various planes of existence, and different ritual actions will shift you along those planes of existence. They'll shift you along a particular trajectory, or as they would say in physics, ritual actions will shift you along a vector, except as it happened, the space of Arcana is not a three-dimensional space or a two-dimensional space. It's an n-dimensional space. It can have an arbitrary number of dimensions which go off in the direction of various gods and planes and aspects of the Tree of Life. And so, you know, the one of the big inspirations behind Arcana is that line that Crowley, Aleister Crowley, has in Liber O, where he says, in this book will be spoken of many things, gods, planes, Sephiroth, demons, spirits. The student should be well advised against ascribing any of these things objective reality or metaphysical validity. By doing certain things happen. So the idea of Arcana, from a gameplay perspective, is that your ritual actions, like lighting candles or placing tarot cards or burning incense, will begin to shift you along a particular axis. And so, you know, inspired by the fiction of R.W. Chambers and his King in Yellow mythos, a lot of our initial rituals have involved moving toward Carcosa and having to reenact the kind of poem incantation from the beginning of the King in Yellow play. But the idea then is to say, okay, we're building this kind of game about the King in Yellow, but we will use that building of the game in order to say, okay, now what kind of visual language, what kind of visual coding environment did we have to have, or would somebody need in order to create their own kind of magic? So the idea of Arcana is that if we can bring enough people into this community and make it all open source and something that many people can contribute to, that the sky's the limit in terms of the way magic could be created. And so some people, you know, maybe they want to implement druidic magic, and some people, maybe they want to do an Enochian system, or maybe some people want to make a magic system from whole cloth that, you know, with the color pie, excuse me, divided up in the way that makes sense in the fictional world that they have created. So that's the idea of Arcana, is to really put a set of combinatorial tools in the hands of end users, where they won't just play Arcana as a game, they'll be able to make their own magic through a tool.
Yeah, that's just so fascinating, because of course it is also partly what we see in the history of the occult. I mean, you mentioned like Andrew Chumley earlier, and you know the visionary novelty of Azoisha, which both is deeply recognizably occult in the sense that it's doing what you know the occult is doing as a sort of thought system, as a way of engaging different colors, planes of reality, god forms, et cetera, et cetera. And yet it's also incredibly novel, because he was sort of a genius and he was able to come up with his own language that then has, you know, has an impact on other people. And it's almost the same way you had a line in the book about how the problem with game design is not when people are influenced by things, but when they're not influenced enough by things. It's like you need to, there's this balance where you have to be able to be influenced by a kind of core set of tools, principles, images, operations, but then also be able to innovate on those in ways that create something new. And Arcana seems really like a wonderful environment, and good luck with that.
Thank you so much. Yeah. The quotation about not being influenced by enough things, in the interest of citation, that comes from my buddy Matt Weiss, who worked on the game Fantasia Music Evolved. So I have been influenced by Matt in saying that, but I definitely believe it to be true. I believe that we are at our most original when we are fusing elements eclectically from different systems. And you know, you could look at Shambhali's Zoroastria next to the Vodouin Gnostic workbook, Mikhail Berthiaud's book, and both of them are equally eclectic and equally visionary, but the way they divide up reality, the way they sort of combine their various influences is deeply different. They're both gourmet cooks, but the dishes that they make with all of their magical influences are just staggeringly diverse and beautiful. So,
well,
yeah.
Jeff, we're going to have to end it there. I'm afraid we're running out of time. Jeff Howard, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you, Eric.
Once again, Jeff Howard's book is called Game Magic, and you can also go online and check out the blog at designquests.com. So check it out. It's pretty great stuff. And so from Majid and me to all you out there, keep your minds open.